Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer and The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Pushkin. In the 13 years since Kevin Parker first posted Tame Impala music on MySpace, he's gone from being a member of Perth, Australia's psych rock scene to a huge Coachella headlining act in the States. In the process, he's developed the best of both worlds. The respect of all your favorite artists and legions of fans who dissect every lyric and sound on his albums. Like most of his past releases, Kevin did everything on the newest Tame Impala album, The Slow Rush, himself. All the singing, playing, production, mixing, everything. He tells Rick Rubin it's how he's most comfortable creating, alone. But in the 5 years between his last record and the new one, he was busy collaborating with The Weeknd, Travis Scott, Kanye West, SZA, and a bunch of other people have talked about wanting to work with him too. Everyone from Dua Lipa to Christina and the Queens. Kevin connected recently with Rick on Zoom. He's been sheltering in place back in Australia ever since the coronavirus interrupted his tour after two sold-out nights at the Forum in LA. He talks with Rick about how being perceived as a band started eating away at him early, and also asks Rick about making two albums he loves, Californication and Yeezus. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and Kevin Parker. And you might hear roosters crowing in the background every once in a while. Unfortunately, sheltering in place sometimes means being surrounded by wild chickens.
What was your introduction to music? What are your first memories of listening to music as a kid?
Like, my dad was kind of a musician by hobby. Like loved music, loved playing music. He played like a cover band, just playing kind of 60s, you know, Beach Boys, Beatles, Rolling Stones covers. And so he would always have sort of guitars and stuff lying around the house and in the garage, I guess.
Of your dad's music, was the first, your first memory of, was of him playing music or of the music he listened to?
The music we listened to, because he would always have music playing in the car. In fact, it's weird because there's this one song that I have this memory of always asking him to play. And I remember there was, every time I heard it was like, you know, I must have been about 4 years old. I was like, Dad, play this song. And to this day, I don't know what that song is. It's heartbreak.
Does your dad still remember?
He passed away about 10 years ago. So yeah, I don't think he would have remembered anyway though. But it's, yeah, I have a feeling it's The Shadows. It's a song by The Shadows.
Do you feel like if you randomly came across the song in life, it would a light bulb would go off and you would say, there it is?
It would probably trigger some sort of weird episode. You know, like wherever I was, I'd probably, you know, just sort of stop and break down in some way. But at the same time, I think it might be a song that I know at the moment by The Shadows, because I have a feeling it was instrumental. And I know that it was really, like, touching and melancholic, which kind of points directly to The Shadows.
And then what was your first music that was yours?
Probably Nirvana. You know, like, I would have been about 11 years old. My friend played me Nirvana. Because we were, like, the first kids in our class to get into music. You know, like, I'd go around his house every Tuesday or something like that after school, and we'd kind of, like, discover rock music. You know, it was this like epiphany, absolute revolution of life, like just like jumping around the room. That, you know, that whole story, which is, you know, probably everyone. But I mean, Nirvana, and then it was kind of just a cascade of Smashing Pumpkins, Silverchair, anything with distorted guitar, anything with drop D tuning. But there was always the kind of part of that music that was kind of it wasn't just like angsty. It was, I kind of discovered the emotion in it, like Smashing Pumpkins, you know, because Smashing Pumpkins has that real kind of sensitivity to it, even though it's just like blaring wall of sound. You know what I mean?
Do you remember when you first started experimenting with making music?
Well, my brother played drums,
so he
older brother or younger brother?
Yeah, he's 2 years older. So he had a drum kit, which I just thought was incredible. I'd like sort of, you know, just watch him, you know, and was kind of like, wow. So obviously I immediately wanted to copy him. We had this tape deck in the music room, which was kind of just a room in the house. We had a tape deck that had a microphone input. Do you remember those like kind of like cassette decks? And for some reason there'd just be like a quarter inch jack in the corner, just says microphone, you know? And so we plugged a microphone into it and just recorded ourselves playing drums just to sort of see what it'd sound like. And then we had this little keyboard sitting in the room as well, like a little Casio kind of thing. And one day I was kind of just playing along to myself, playing drums with the cat. Like, I didn't even know how to play. I was just hitting random notes, you know, it sounded like a nursery rhyme probably. And then I noticed in the room there was a second cassette deck with the same thing. So I stuck the mic into that and recorded myself just hitting these keys over the top of me playing drums and listened back to that tape. And it was me playing keyboard to myself. It was me playing two things at once. It blew my mind.
How old were you then?
Still would have been about 11.
Amazing.
Yeah. yeah.
When did the idea of starting to do it with the ideas of making it for other people to hear start?
Well, I mean, like every young teenage musician, I had like grandiose dreams of being a rock star, especially because my favorite band was Silverchair and they were only like 15, 16. And I was sort of like 12, 13 by that point. I was like, they're fucking like 15, 16. That means I've got like 2-3 years. Like 2-3 years, I can still get to where they are. I can be them, you know.
Do you think it had to do with how young they were? Because they were such little kids?
Yeah, for whatever reason. Whether it was because they were like young Australian boys, or because like they would have been in a similar headspace, you know, that they kind of like their approach to it would have been in the same realm as mine.
How did you decide to end up being a solo artist as opposed to being in a band?
Well, I played in bands the whole time in high school. Like, I was obsessed with the idea of playing in bands, but I also had the making music thing at home. Since before I accidentally multi-tracked myself that time, I was playing in a band. It was kind of this this music school that I went to where, like, they teach you an instrument. Mine was drums. And then every Saturday morning, they get all the kids from different instrument like tuitions and put them in bands. So they put me in a band. So I was in a band at age 11, which I fucking loved. I could not wait. I could not wait for Saturday morning to come around because it was like, you know, playing music with other kids was just this another mind-blowing thing. But I slowly got better at that, and I slowly got better at recording music by myself. And the two worlds never really met. Like, even at the start of, like, Tame Impala, when I was sort of, like, 21, 22, we were playing songs that I'd written for us to play live, and they were different to the ones I was recording at home that we even had on MySpace. It took a while for the two worlds to kind of converge, if that makes sense, because I just didn't know how. I didn't know how to translate what I was kind of doing at home and, like, expressing on my own. Because that music was, like, super kind of, I guess sensitive is the word, and kind of nuanced and genreless. But the music I was making in bands, I mean, like, that was music was more kind of like what we had listened to as a group, like kind of more angsty, like heavy kind of stuff.
At the time that you started making music with the idea of putting it up on MySpace, what would you say the influences were? What were you listening to, and what might have been, who would you have hoped to get to play with, for example?
That was around the time that I was super kind of obsessed with 60s music. So it was all like The Doors, Jefferson Airplane. I didn't have a lot of kind of like modern day idols, just because of like, that was the kind of lifestyle I was leading. And like, I was living in a share house with other people. We were just permanently listening to 70s psych rock constantly. There was this band called Dung Yen that I was super into. I still am to this day. That's it still just gives me goosebumps, you know? Yeah, and like, it's funny because I listen now and I can hear my first album all over it, you know? It's something I didn't really notice at the time consciously, but just like yeah.
And then how would you describe how the second album differed from the first?
It was 100 times more indulgent, which is what I wanted, you know, because I'd had this kind of like surge of confidence that I didn't have prior. You know, like when I made it in a speaker, I was this kind of like shy stoner kind of, you know. And you know, like we had a lot of success the first album. We went on tours and all this kind of stuff. And so I suddenly realized that it kind of validated my approach and my kind of like what I wanted to do. So Lonerism was kind of like just blowing that wide open.
How did the third album, when that came, how was that different?
The second album, I still didn't fully know what I was doing. I kind of like, I got Ableton and instead of just sort of it being the corner of my bedroom in a share house that I made it, for the second album, I was like, fuck it. All right, I'm going to dedicate to this, you know? So I set up a studio in a room in my share house. My studio got its own full room for once. And I would just make hours and hours of, I was using synths, organs, fucking anything. You know, it was kind of just that, you know, that kind of typical moment for a solo artist where they make their you know, their self-indulgent opus. It really was that, looking back. Like at the time I was like, fuck yeah, you know.
And it seemed like the first two albums, the arrangement seemed more complicated.
Yeah, that's probably true, because in the third one I was kind of like influenced by a lot of kind of R&B and electronic music, so I was kind of embracing the way that music was made more. Do you know what I mean? Sort of like finding a loop and kind of like almost kind of making a beat, like a, you know, in like the hip hop sense, like sort of just having like a 4-bar loop and just sort of making the structure out of that, rather than going like, okay, we're going to be going with this bit for a while, we're going to jam on these chords and then like do a huge drum fill and go into these chords and then let this thing for 5.5 bars.
Do you remember what the music that inspired that switch? Like, what would have been the things you were listening to that made you want to make more program-based music?
I mean, like, it was always music that I was into, but just music that I'd kind of shied away from making because I figured, like, my world was weird, expansive psych rock. And, like, if I tried to do more clean, focused pop kind of stuff, I assumed it wouldn't work. You know, so Currents was the album where I'd kind of like just went, fuck it, I'm going to try it, you know. Try and make kind of like disco R&B, kind of like really the beats are like super strong and heavy.
Would you consider the first two as a pair and the last two as a pair?
No, I've never thought of it that way. I don't know, maybe some people would. I guess with the third one where I was, is the one where I was kind of like, I knew that there would be fans of the first two that turn their noses up. Like I was ready for that. Do you know what I mean? I was kind of like, I decided, you know, kind of definitively that I wanted to change my sound, and I knew that some people wouldn't like it. You know what I mean? That was kind of that part in my career where I kind of like sucked it up. Do you know what I mean?
It's a great thing to do early on. If you'd made four albums that sounded in the same vein, and then the fifth one was different, it would have probably alienated more people.
Yeah.
It's like you did it early enough in the trajectory where you let the audience know that, hey, we're going to go on different rides and I want you to come with me. And I think people are more forgiving of the style changes if you prepare them for it.
Yeah. Yeah, if change is one of the constants.
Yeah, it's like if the Ramones' fifth album all of a sudden was a programmed dance record, I don't think anybody would have been excited about that.
Right. And also something I realized was that, I mean, what's funny is that the first album and the second one, Tame Impala was always kind of perceived as a band. And I was kind of cool with that. Because it sounded like a band. People were like, oh, you know, it sounds like a bunch of guys jamming. You know, like I love this. I love these guys. You know, I love the way they jam out. But I kind of like it. Kind of, it was eating away at me that it wasn't like the truth. I wanted people to know that it was kind of more of a solo recording project, because I realized that solo artists get away with completely changing their sound a lot more than bands do. You know, like with someone like Beck, you know, Beck can just take a complete left turn with one album, you know. And everyone will be like, oh, well, that's Beck. You know, that's what he does. But like with a band, it's kind of like, I feel like a few things have to happen. Like everyone in the band, or everyone in the group rather, has to like decide on it together, which is more difficult. You know, they all have to be sort of like moving in the same direction, whereas people, especially as time goes by, people like drift apart.
When you decided to give the project a name originally as opposed to your name, was it the opposite of what you just said? Was the original impression was for it to seem like a band?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the record label, when they signed us, didn't even know we were I didn't know it was me that was playing drums and guitars and bass and multi-tracking. Like I outright lied to them when we met up. Like the contract that we signed was for three of us. I didn't want to say it was just me, you know? For a number of reasons. Like, number one, I was kind of shy. It's really weird because looking back, it's kind of like, why the fuck didn't you just like own it, you know? But also like the kind of music scene I was in was a very communal scene, you know? Like we lived to jam and lived to like play gigs. So like for the thing that finally came out of that scene to be just one, like a solo project thing, it felt kind of wrong. Because it would be the kind of this like scene that we kind of had going in Perth, where it's kind of like a bunch of us, but there weren't that many people, but we made tons of bands out of it, you know? So there'd be like 10 people and there'd be like six bands with like different combinations of those people just because, you know, like, hey, why the fuck not?
When we come back, we'll have more with Kevin Parker.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
We're back with Rick and Kevin Parker.
Feels like it was like 4 or 5 years between the third album and the new album.
Mm-hmm.
And during that 4 years, you didn't write songs or make any music?
I did. I absolutely did. But I just didn't see it as Tame Impala. And it kind of seemed more like a drag to think of a song as Tame Impala. Because it, like, every time I thought of a song, if I imagine it as Tame Impala, it came loaded. Like, the idea was loaded with all these kind of things that came with it. Like, it just seemed so much more magical and wondrous to think of it as a song I could collaborate with a different artist on. You know, like me making Tame Impala music now, or and always, it's like, it's a deep, dark hole that I have to go into and, you know, like come out, like it drains every bit of me, you know. And I realized that at the end, like working at the end of the third album, you know, I always dreamt of making a Tame Impala album where I didn't feel completely spent at the end of it, like completely drained and completely like depressed even. And I kind of realized after a while that that was inevitable and that was the only way it could be.
In the course of those 4 years before you started working on the new album, did it reveal itself that it was time, or was it a decision you made, or did one particular track come up where you felt like, oh, this could be the beginning of something?
It was a combination of the first two. You know what it was? It was more like it was the process of it. Because I'd fallen in love so much with this idea of music being a collaborative thing. You know, like the energy in a room when you're working with other people, like, you know, I started working with Travis Scott, someone like that. Like the energy in the room is just so electric, you know? And I was like, hey, I can have that energy on my own too. I just have to embrace it, you know? And so then I started, so like the way I started working on the album again was by like pretending I was in a recording session with a bunch of other people, you know, staying up late, just getting drunk and stoned, you know, and kind of just having a party by myself. I guess just embracing that kind of way that when you're on the in the depths of working by yourself, you feel like many people.
Do you feel like you're channeling particular people, or is it more of a general feeling of this is not me, it's someone else? Or do you envision, oh, Travis is here with me, what would he do?
Both, but in different times. It's like me imagining I'm someone else is kind of more when I get stuck. You know, it's like what would Pharrell Williams do in this moment? You know, actually, it's funny. One of the things that got me inspired, I started watching. There's this like 6-part YouTube video series on the making of Justified, and it almost seems like leaked footage because it's just fly on the wall. Someone's just holding a video camera the entire time. It starts from like them in Justin Timberlake's private jet, and they're flying to the recording session. But most of it is just someone sitting on the couch, like filming Pharrell and Justin, kind of messing around, like having a laugh, and like making this song. So you can see Pharrell kind of piece together Señorita. So like there's like, you know, like a 20-minute patch of him just sort of playing drums. That's not how it starts out, but you see him slowly converge on the beat that ends up being Señorita, you know. And he's like, okay, gets up and he's like, okay, loop that back, da da da. And I don't know why, but for some reason that kind of just made me think about how I make music. And it reminded me, in fact, one of the songs on the album kind of like came out sounding similar to something I would imagine Pharrell and Justin would be doing for Justin Timberlake, which is the song Breathe Deeper. The first, the beat from the start of Breathe Deeper was kind of me pretending I was Pharrell and Justin making Justified.
Let me ask a specific question. You often have little intro, signature intros that are not necessarily part of the track. You know, like the drum, it'll either be a different beat or it sounds really different and it sets up the song, but it doesn't feel like it's part of the song. Do those happen after?
I guess that's just me trying to just create those kind of moments of like jolting into the track, you know, like in the way that you hear in hip hop, in the way that like just cutting to something completely different is sometimes one of the most satisfying things. And so sometimes it can be an accident, like I accidentally play the track wrong. For example, the start of Backward, Feels Like We Only Go Backwards on Lonerism was me. I had it on loop. I had one beat on loop that's kind of like, you know, the last beat of the chorus or something. You know, I had it and it went like, draw, draw, draw. And I was like, oh, shit, you know. That's one of the, like, I don't have many happy accidents in this year. That's not true. I do. I have a lot. But that's just one of those happy accidents, you know. So I guess I'm just always on the lookout for things that can sort of like take you one way and then quickly back the other, you know what I mean?
And so more often, some accident might happen somewhere during the course of making the song and you might think, oh, maybe I can use this piece at some point. And then you figure out how to use it, or might you have a finished song and think, okay, now I need an intro and I don't want it to be like the rest?
I mean, those kind of things, those kind of moments, those accidents, it's almost something that I rely on happening, you know? And because like, you know, I like to record pretty late at night sometimes. I like to get kind of just spaced out. And, you know, in those times, I'm not very musically proficient, you know? But because you're not consciously aware of everything you're doing, it frees you from the boring, straight down the line cognitive thinking that you do. You know, it's that kind of...
So it's almost like your subconscious is involved in the writing process.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I try to bring that as much as possible because I'm someone that naturally... I'll try and process everything. You know, I'm probably... more naturally an overthinker than I'd like to be, you know? So like smoking weed in a recording session, that's kind of just something I do to stop myself from overthinking. Because that's a time when I'm just like, oh yeah, that's cool. Let's go with that. You know, like, oh, that's sick. Don't think about it. Don't fucking think about it. You know? Not that you need to be stoned to get into that kind of space, but all those kind of times. It's also like being in a heightened emotional state, like feeling super emotional in whichever direction is also something that brings out that where you're not thinking about whether something's good. It's just it hits a spot of you because you're feeling depressed or because you're feeling elated or you know, particularly joyous or particularly sad. Those are times when you don't overthink things too.
Are all of these things we're talking about all instrumental at this point, where we're at in talking about making music and those feelings that you get excited about? Are we only talking about instrumental at this point?
No, it can happen all at once. I mean, in fact, like most of the ideas I have for songs are ideas I've had not even in the studio. And that's kind of the other thing about catching you off guard is that songs come to me when I'm not thinking about writing a song, you know? In fact, if I consciously decide that I want to write a song, you can pretty much guarantee it's going to be the shittest song I've ever written. I've often tried to like research like when it is that an idea will come to me, and like the only thing I can that I've noticed like a pattern or whatever is like going from like a loud place or like a place where there's a lot of energy into walking outside, stepping outside from a room of people, suddenly going from like lots of shit going on, thinking about it, and then suddenly nothing. And then my brain has to find some way of filling that void that suddenly appeared. I think that's something. That's a lead.
Yeah, that sounds great. The fact that you noticed that is really, it's a beautiful note and really helpful for you that I'm so happy that you realized it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I like to think I'm a sciencey person. So I'm always like, how does that happen? Not so that I can fabricate it or not that I can like force it to happen, but just because I want to know. You know, I'm just curious, like, what makes me think of 10 songs in 3 days sometimes and then nothing for 5 months?
Okay, so now let's say you just left a loud room where there's a lot going on. You stepped outside and it's silent. What might one of these seed ideas look like? What would be the first thing that would come?
It's like flicking on the radio.
Melody, lyric, both?
Both, all at the same time. Yeah, it's like flicking on the radio. And it's like flicking on the radio because it's not like starting the song at the start. It's not like a song starts, you know, 0.00 song starts. It's like coming in halfway through a chorus, you know.
Yeah, it's a vibe. You pick up on the vibe.
Yeah, and then I just do my best. I do my best to get to a place where I can record it before I forget it. So I've obviously got like 100 voice memos on my phone. It'll be like a 2-bar or 1-bar bit of music. So the drums will be the drums. I mean, let's try and find one. But it's rare that I'll listen back to it and decide that it was good enough. Just, I don't know why. It's like someone singing your ears, like, hey man, what about this? It goes, da da na na na. And sometimes at the end of my note, I like feel compelled to go, record this. Just fucking record it. This won't sound like much. You listen to it, but record it.
No, play one. I'd love to hear it. Put it up to the mic.
I don't know what you get out of hurting me.
This is very candid, I hope you know. So that's obviously like the kind of the rhythm section. And then skipping. That's the vocal melody. Yeah. So I guess like often I'll go back and just like force myself to record one of those. I haven't recorded that one. That's the first time I've listened to it. I'd say about 9 out of 10 ideas that I have, I'll forget because I'll be meaning to like record up my voice memo, but someone will be next. I'll be like talking to someone and then we'll get into a car with the car radio playing and it'll absolutely just wipe. It'll wipe whatever I'm thinking, you know.
You got to catch them fast.
Absolutely. And easily forgotten too. And I always feel bad about going, I always feel a bit kind of ego about it, egomaniac about going like, hang on guys, can everyone just shut up? Can everyone just shut up, please? I've got an idea, you know? Like I could never do that in a room full of people or with anyone I'm with.
Here's a suggestion. Go to the bathroom.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, but there's music playing in bathrooms sometimes. But yeah, no.
You know, Neil Young has a rule that regardless of what is going on in the moment, where he is or what he's doing, if a song comes to him, everything stops.
Yeah, I love it.
And he gets that idea down before that goes away because he knows it's fleeting and we don't have control of them coming. Like you said, sometimes you might get a bunch in a couple of days, but then you might go months without getting another one. So they really are valuable. And they're also valuable because they're all different and you never know which one is the great one. You know,
yeah,
like maybe one of the best ones evaporated.
Yeah, that's true. I firmly believe, genuinely believe that I could have songs that are my best songs or whatever. You know, like there's definitely things that have disappeared that would have been great, but that's just life, you know?
Okay, well, I'm going to give you permission to always either ask people to be quiet or to invite you to leave where you are to go capture these ideas because they're good for the world. You're doing a service to the world.
Wow, that's actually really powerful to hear from you, Rick Rubin. Can I get a little soundbite from you saying like, hey, everyone, can you get the fuck out? Kevin needs to record something. Just so I can play it to them. Like, just like, hey.
I will make one for you and send it.
Amazing. That would be amazing. Just like, hey guys, Rick Rubin here. I love
so
it.
Funny.
When we come back, we'll have more with Kevin Parker. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
We're back with Rick and Kevin Parker from Tame Impala.
Do you listen to music for fun a lot?
I don't, and I want to more. I have less and less since I started making music. Since music became the thing that I do, I've been more and more preoccupied with making it, so I haven't given myself time to listen to it. Like, it's extremely difficult for me to justify putting on an album to listen to over potentially thinking of a song. Because for me, like, if I put on an album, that's an hour that I won't have an idea, you know? I'm that obsessed with coming up with a new, with like, finding a new song, making a new song. Because making a new song makes me feel like nothing else in the world. There's no other feeling in the world that I get from the feeling of starting a new song that I think has really great potential. Sadly, more so than listening to something that is great, you know. But I do want to force myself to listen to more music. I heard Tyler the Creator in his Nardwuar interview the other day. He said like he wakes up every morning and listens to 2 hours of music he hasn't heard before. And I was like, fuck, that's amazing. I want to do that, you know. Just like,
yeah. Have you ever started a song with another song in mind?
Like a song that already exists, like a song that's already been released.
Yeah, just like a song, like a song that you,
mean?
A song from the 60s, and you think, wow, this is my inspiration. What would I do that would be in this vein? I'm not suggesting copying it, but I'm saying being inspired by it to want to make something that makes you feel like that feels.
Not that I know of, but something that I do sometimes kind of subconsciously, there might be a song playing in the background, like, you know, like on the radio or something. And then get switched off. And then I'll think of something that goes on from there. I'll have the rhythm and maybe the key in my mind, just subconsciously, and I'll just start singing a song that goes on from that, as though the song kept going, but it changed. There's an example of that, which I don't know if I feel like I'm going to get busted. Well, you know what? Fuck it. It was 2012. No, there's a song. Well, my song Feels Like We Only Go Backwards. I must have been listening to I've traced it back. I think I was listening to this song by Beach House earlier that morning. It's called Walk in the Park, I think. And it's funny because it's the same tempo and the same key and possibly even similar chords. But it was, for me, like at the time, it was too much of a coincidence. And I'm pretty sure it was around that time that song came out. So I'm pretty sure that I'd done that with that song. Kind of like that song had stopped and then I'd kind of just like, my brain had continued it on, same tempo and same key, you know. Maybe even like, there's probably even like a little motif in there that's the same kind of combo of two or three notes. Do you know what I mean? So that's something that happens.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything, I think all great artists are heavily inspired by other artists and it's only good.
Yeah, what's funny is that when I say that now, it doesn't seem that bad. but I think back then I used to be so precious about like the sacredity of melodies and the sacredness of artistry being wholly, wholly as in like WH, da da da, inspired and not influenced by anything. So like back then I would have thought that was terrible, but now that I say it out loud, it's kind of, that's just one of the ways that like a great song can come about. And then especially like I discovered well, not discover, but like I appreciated hip hop more and like sampling and stuff like that. So, you know, that's another whole realm of taking music that already exists.
Yeah, I think creative use of a sample to create something new is, it's just a new form. It's like, it's a great new form of creativity, a beautiful way to express yourself, to flip something for a new use, like recycling. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's also a completely other category of skill that can be mastered. You know, I guess that's something that I didn't realize early on when I started, you know, when I was like making psych rock and stuff. Not that I've sampled myself, but like I used to think like someone's done that already. Like, how can you take credit for that? But finding that in itself and realizing how it can be reimagined and like represented is extremely difficult, especially when there's a universe of music out there. Like, finding the right thing to use and how to use it is something that I admire extremely now.
Yeah, it can happen. Even with cover songs, a different artist can take the same song that someone else did, and just through their interpretation of it, completely change the meaning of the song. You know, it's there's so much that can happen in the personalization process of music.
Fully, like that Mad World song, you know, it's a cover. Yeah. It's really that really somber song.
Yes.
And it's like, how could this song have ever been anything else other than this, you know?
Yes, the cover version is spectacular.
Yeah.
And if you listen back to the original, it's cool, but the cover is it.
Yeah, exactly.
Great example. The first Bee Gees hit was a song that they wrote for Otis Redding. Do you know the story?
No, I want to know
to
that.
To Love Somebody.
Oh, okay.
To Love Somebody.
Yeah.
The way I love you. They wrote that for Otis Redding. And then Otis Redding died and never got to record it. And then they recorded it themselves and put it out. But when you hear that song, you don't think of Otis Redding. You think of the Bee Gees. It's like, it's a classic Bee Gees song.
It's a
great example of a song with, in their mind, that was for someone else.
Yeah, I like hearing stories like that. It's kind of comforting for me to know that there is that kind of uncertainty that artists have as well with where a song should end up.
Anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm tempted to ask you about everything you've done, but I don't know, that's probably something you've done a million times. What was recording Californication like? Just because that was one of the albums that like was big for me. That was kind of like my first year of high school album that I was kind of obsessed with.
Well, with the typically the way it worked with the Chili Peppers is they would write songs on their own for a long period of time, and then we would get together in pre-production, and they would play me songs in various stages of completion, and we would talk about them and discuss strengths and weaknesses and how they could maybe be better, and whether they had too many parts or whether they had maybe not enough parts.
Yeah,
and then we would usually, by the time of that album, really work up the songs as a live band in the rehearsal room, so that when we went into the studio, it was purely just getting the performance. Like everything was worked out completely just with the players.
Wow.
Maybe not all of the words.
Yeah.
But I think back then, maybe many of the words were already written, where they could perform it live. And the goal of that really was to not confuse the writing process with the performance process, so that when we were in the studio, we really knew what we were doing, and still we might play the same song 100 times to get it to just come together in that way where it feels like it's the perfect version, but it's also got mistakes in it. And it's, you know, it's natural. It's just, it sounds like a band on a really good night. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it doesn't sound like machines playing it. It sounds like the best night that they played that on tour. Yeah. This was, we happened to catch the best one. So gotcha. We would play things over and over with that idea. And some would happen very quickly, some would take a long time. And then all of the overdubs would happen after that, and we would make decisions of things to try. And we would usually record many, many, many more songs than whatever was on the album. Pretty much always the case.
Wow. Yeah.
Like,
wow.
I would say for every album we made, there were at least twice as many songs as the songs that were on the album.
And what happened to them?
Did that
eventually come out on B-side on kind of...
Some have, some haven't.
Wow. That's crazy. Because like for me, that's such a wild thing to think. Because for me, like I just make the songs that I need for an album. Like a song will not get past... Well, it won't get past anywhere close to halfway finished unless I know it's going to be on the album. So I rarely ever have B-sides of any kind. So the idea of, to think of like a complete other, like a parallel universe album that never existed. That's funny because it's sung on Californication. But I guess that's how most artists
have you noticed. Yeah. Have you noticed how a song, when you first get excited about it, and you think, "Oh, I've worked on these songs, but this new one is my favorite of the batch so far," and then as you work further, it maybe doesn't become your favorite of the batch. And then another song that you think, well, this is pretty good, but maybe not my favorite song, that as you continue working on it, it becomes your favorite song. Have you ever had that experience or no?
Well, my thing is like, for a song to make an album, it has to at some point have been my favorite song ever. Like I have to have had a moment with that song. Like it has to, like for at least a day, it has to have been just like my favorite thing I've ever done, you know? It can never be like, just for some reason, like I won't bother going through with a song unless at some point I've thought that it's like potential is limitless, or it could be the greatest thing I've done. Like, and like greatest, not just greatest, like, oh, it could, you know, be the most critically acclaimed or whatever, but just the greatest, you know? Like, I guess for me, the thing is like from starting a song and having all these and just thinking it's and having a moment with it and feeling great about it, it's kind of just like a race to the finish line to get the song finished and have me still feel the same way about it, or just for me to still love it, you know?
Do you always finish one song before moving on to the next song?
No. I mean, like hours up until mastering, I'm still writing lyrics. Oh, for a song, for like up until, you know, a few hours before it's done, of like a year of working on it, I'm sort of like writing and recording lyrics and editing drums. And, you know, so I do everything at once because my attention span is too short to, or my kind of like my work, I have horrible work ethic. So for me to sit down and do like one task until it's done is extremely rare. You know, I'll sort of like be recording a bass line for it and get sort of like halfway down there and go, oh, I'm going to do something else now. You know, I'm going to stay. And because that's the luxury of doing it by myself. I can do it without it derailing the session, you know. So I can kind of just like, oh, you know, now I want to think of some lyrics, or now I want to just do a bit of mixing, you know, or I want to edit some drums, you know. I'll do everything at once, and then which can sort of like create this sort of like complete mess of and can make me feel can make you lost in the progress of a song. So sometimes I'm like, oh, I don't know where I am with this song. I don't know if it's almost finished or if it's nowhere near there, you know? So I'm kind of just like lost in the woods.
Do you ever go too far and have to backtrack?
Yes, I mean I hate backtracking, but yes, which is interesting. I've always wanted to know, and like maybe you're not able to say because of, you know, it's like secret or whatever. But with Yeezus, you know, because there's the myth that there's the story that he came to you sort of a couple of weeks before it was done, and you kind of went like. let's get rid of that, let's get rid of that, and like strip it down, which to me, like that story is like, is this holy grail of discipline, like executive discipline to say like, we don't need any of this, you know? Because for me, that's it's extremely hard. If I recorded a part for a song, it's extremely difficult for me to say it doesn't need to be in the song, because like my brain's like, oh no, there'll be a place for it, you know? So my songs can end up being so extremely dense, and I'm just sort of finding a way to sort of like fit in there. But to me, like the greatest strength and the greatest ability in production is to say all of this stuff here doesn't need to be, you know? So I really want to know how that like happened.
Well, you have to be ruthless in the edit. And
right. I like that word, ruthless.
It's the right word, because you have to be comfortable taking your favorite part out of a song if it doesn't serve the song. The most important thing is that what's presented is the best that it could possibly be. And it's not a collection of things in that one song. It's what makes this song the best it could possibly be. And anything that doesn't need to be there needs to go. And I would say just the opposite in terms of, I never feel bad about taking stuff out. But then again, you know, from the beginning, that's always been my instinct, is to have the least amount of stuff, to get the idea across with the least amount of stuff. Doesn't mean that that's, I'll say that that's an organizing principle for the way I work, but then sometimes we'll decide, oh, let's put a bunch of stuff on this, and that's the way we like it. It's fine. So it's not a rule to live by, but it's a way of thinking, and there's a reason for it, which is when you clear as much space as possible, the things that are left, you really hear them. You really feel their personality.
Totally.
There's less jockeying for your attention.
Totally.
So each thing gets to live in its own space. And that space is what makes things sound so beautiful. It's really, you know, the old adage, the quiet between the notes.
Yeah, exactly. Man, that's truly remarkable, because for me, it's like, it would be torture to do something like that, you know? Like the idea, for me, because I'm listening to you go, I'm like, oh, fuck, you know? Because my brain, the place my brain goes to is like, how can a song be the best that it can be without your favorite bit in the song?
Well, the favorite bit might end up being a different song.
Yeah, true.
It's like what serves the song. Same. It's like it's one of the things that I learned early on working with bands who are really great players. Is that most great players want to show that they're great players, and there isn't much room for that in recording. In recording, it really is what needs to be there to best serve the song. It's not in service unless of course it's, you know, a Guitar Hero album and it's really about showing the dexterity of the player.
No,
but if it's about the songs, it's never about the coolest part. It's about how the parts interact to make the greatest whole. And sometimes the thing that's really cool ends up being a distraction.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's kind of like the kind of philosophy that I'm developing in myself at the moment, you know? Because like so much of my music has been this kind of like this like layered psych rock kind of symphonies, you know, like with Lonerism was kind of like the pinnacle of that, where because it was so indulgent, it was like, oh, I'm gonna do this synth melody, oh, I'm gonna do this fucking guitar line, oh, this bass line's gonna come in here, you know, and it was like packed in. So it's like a really sonically, it's a really interesting album to listen to, because nothing really jumps out at you except all these bits, which is, it's simultaneously what's wrong with it, but also what's kind of like charming and beautiful about it. But you know, like that kind of discipline that you're talking about is something that I see as kind of one of the greatest wisdoms to have. You know, being able to sense what a piece of music needs and what it doesn't need.
And the idea that maybe for a particular project, you want it to be super dense and, you know, stepping on itself. And that's what makes that project that project. That's fine. So it's not like everything has to be that way. It's more of a...
No, you're right.
It's in the bag of tricks. It's in the bag of tricks.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. I guess I just feel like, that's kind of like a... Because it's a new and wonderful thing for me. It's kind of... It's one of those things I'm curious about, you know?
Well, the next time that we're both in the same place and our... and the world is a world where we're allowed to be in the same room, then... Let's get together and listen to music together, and I bet it'll be fun.
Fuck yeah, man. That sounds good. I'd love that.
Thanks to Kevin Parker for jumping on Zoom to talk with Rick about his new album. Be sure to check out The Slow Rush along with our other favorite Tame Impala songs on a playlist we created at brokenrecordpodcast.com. You should also know we'll be taking a little break over the next 2 weeks, but we'll be back May 19th with new episodes for you. In the meantime, stay in touch with us on Instagram at The Broken Record Pod. Shoot us a message if there's an interview you really want to hear us do. And dive into old episodes of the podcast you might have missed on whatever podcast app you use or on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/brokenrecordpodcast. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mila Bell, Leah Rose, and Martin Gonzalez for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.
MuseAura is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of MuseAura, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to MuseAura.com, MuseAura.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.